Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, it's not often that advanced technology is in the news, but lately, two tech topics have been getting a lot of attention. One is artificial intelligence, or AI. We've done a couple of shows on AI in the past year or so, its potential rewards and really its risks, too. And the other is the rapid advances that are being made in nuclear fusion. The reason for the excitement about fusion is the prospect for fusion energy to become an inexhaustible, cheap, clean and safe form of energy that could finally break us away from the addiction to fossil fuels that causes constant geopolitical strife as well as damaging effects on the environment, in particular climate change. So several countries and several universities and government labs in this country, and even some private companies, have made breakthroughs over the past year or so in the search for workable ways to harness fusion energy. My guest is Dr. Larry Baylor, the head of Fusion Nuclear Science, Technology, and Engineering at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. Now that's a mouthful. Who is a key member and leader of one of the teams pursuing this field. He's here with us today to give us an overview of the different approaches to fusion research and where we stand with them and what the potential benefits of fusion are. Welcome, Dr. Baylor.
It's great to be with you, Court.
Thanks for being with us. Can I call you Larry from here on?
Yes, please.
Good. Well, let's start by talking about the difference between nuclear fission and nuclear fusion. So what is it?
Fission is the process where atoms of heavy elements such as uranium or thorium are split and release energy when they split in the form of neutrons and thermal energy that can be harnessed to make electricity in a fission reactor. And this has been developed and in use since the 1940s during the Manhattan Project. Fusion, on the other hand, is the combining of light elements where they collide together and form heavier elements, such as hydrogen, into helium, and that releases energy as well, also in the form of energetic neutrons. And that is the process that goes on in the stars and our own sun. And it produces about four times as much energy than does fission.
Yeah, so that's one advantage. And so nuclear fission is what powers, as you said, today's nuclear power plants and also powers nuclear weapons, right? So, you know, it's got its pros and cons, obviously. But what are its advantages of fission compared to coal and oil-fired plants?
Well, both fission and fusion have the advantage over coal and fossil fuels in that they do not produce any environmental impacts to exhaust gases that can be detrimental to the climate or to what we breathe. And so that energy that comes from both fission and fusion is considered clean energy.
Yeah, so I can remember the assurance that nuclear energy back in, oh, I don't know, the 50s or so, would provide electricity that was, quote, too cheap to meter. So much for that, right?
Yes, that turned out not to be quite the case.
One of those marketing pitches, I guess. But anyway, so what are its drawbacks? And here we're talking about fission again. What are the drawbacks of nuclear fission? You mentioned a couple, but let's kind of go down the list with them.
Yeah, one of the main potential drawbacks for fission is that it produces nuclear waste. So the reacting material in the reactor, once it has been burned or produces all of the energy that it can, you're left with spent fuel that is highly radioactive. It cannot be handled manually. It can only be handled remotely and has to be kept under cover and is generally kept in pools of water at the reactor site, in fact, and so that people are not harmed by this radioactive material. And it stays radioactive at a dangerous level for tens of thousands of years. And so it's really an issue as to coming up with a scheme where this spent fuel can be kept safe for many generations to come.
Yeah, that's a big drawback. So, you know, there's also the danger of meltdown. I mean, we saw that first with Three Mile Island and then with Chernobyl in Russia. And, you know, it's rare, but it does happen. And when it does happen, it can be catastrophic. We saw it in Japan not all that many years ago.
Yes, that's certainly true. There are new designs for fission reactors that are inherently safe, that do not have this drawback. They have built-in cooling systems that keep the fuel from melting, such as what happened at Fukushima, when the tsunami took out all the cooling systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also limited fuel supply. I mean, they feed on certain isotopes of uranium, which are rare, hard to get, and have their own geopolitical consequences just providing the fuel for them. Is that a drawback, too, for fission plants?
It is. Our current generation of fission plants use uranium, and they have to enrich that uranium, which means isotopically separate the uranium to have more of the uranium-235 isotope that is preferable for use in the reactor. And that takes a lot of energy to separate that uranium, so there is a fair amount of energy used to do that separation. Another drawback for fission is that it produces elements such as plutonium, which can be used in nuclear weapons. And so there's one has to be very careful in deploying a fission reactor that bad actors are not able to take advantage of that fuel that is produced that could be used in a weapon.
Yeah, so it, you know, it has certainly clear benefits, but the drawbacks and the potential problems with it range from serious to very serious, right? So you know, so it's not ideal, and which has led to the conflicting attitudes and policies toward nuclear power over the decades in this country, right? So set of overreactions to the drawbacks and the dangers in some respects, but you know, it's understandable. Well, let's compare nuclear fission with fusion energy, Larry. Once fusion does become commercially viable, which it's not yet, we're just talking about it being kind of in the phase of rapid advances being made right now. All of a sudden, so what are the advantages and disadvantages of fusion over fission?
Well, one of the main advantages of fusion over fission is that the fuel is readily available, at least part of the fuel. Most people are thinking in terms of deuterium and tritium, the two heavy isotopes of hydrogen, for use as the fuel. Deuterium occurs naturally, and it's in seawater and can be easily separated from the natural hydrogen atoms. Mm. But the other element, tritium, does not occur in nature and has to be made in a reaction with lithium. People, I'm sure, have heard of lithium in batteries for everything from cell phones to other larger battery systems. And so lithium, when it's bombarded with neutrons, can turn into tritium. And so all of the tritium, deuterium-tritium fusion reactors that are being designed have a blanket of lithium compounds surrounding the reaction that will absorb neutrons that then turn into more tritium fuel. So the tritium fuel in the reactor has to be bred by the reactor itself.
You mentioned earlier one of the big advantages, which is the much greater energy output of fusion reactions over fission reactions. So kind of elaborate just briefly on that, if you would.
Yes, the fusion reaction produces a lot of energy per reaction, and that has a big advantage. However, it's much more difficult to cause that reaction to happen than for a fission reaction. Splitting an atom takes a relatively low energy neutron to hit the uranium or thorium atom, and it will then split into two and release more neutrons and energetic sub-atoms, smaller atoms. In fusion, it takes a very high temperature for this deuterium and tritium elements to collide with enough energy to make a fusion reaction. And that's why it has taken so long, over 60 years of trying to make fusion into an energy source, because it's extremely difficult to get the hydrogen isotopes into a state called a plasma, where they're very energetic. They are completely stripped of their electrons. So it's the plasma is a soup of ions and electrons, and those ions have to have enough energy over a temperature of 100 million degrees C in order to react enough to produce useful amounts of fusion reactions.
So I gather that in fusion, the key is to produce more energy than you use to achieve the reaction. So you get a net energy gain.
Yes.
And that, you know, as you said, for nearly a century, that's been the goal of kind of the holy grail of nuclear scientists for a long time, but it has been an elusive goal. And I can remember the excitement back in 1989, I'm sure you do too, when two scientists announced that they had achieved cold fusion in a bottle, but that was quickly proven to be wrong. However, for about a week, there was an extreme excitement all around the world in the scientific community that that might be possible. You can make fusion out of basically nothing, and but it wasn't the case. So the goal remained elusive until now, and U.S. scientists first achieved that net energy gain in a fusion reaction in December 2022 at the National Ignition Facility in California. And they did it again last July in a reaction that produced a higher energy yield even than in the first one. So this was big news. But the commercial availability of electricity produced by fusion is still a long way away. We don't want to make people think that, you know, this is going to be next year or something. You know, so that's kind of where we stand. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Larry Baylor, who is a scientist at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, who's a key member and leader of one of the teams pursuing nuclear fusion and the goal of making it commercially usable as a source of energy. So let's talk, Larry, about the different approaches to fusion that are being pursued right now. And there are a couple of them, at least. There's magnetic confinement. I mean, what's that about?
So there's two primary ways to make fusion reactions. One is called inertial fusion, which is the implosion of the deuterium and tritium fuel using lasers or X-rays. And the experimental result that you mentioned from a year ago and has been repeated now three or four times at the National Ignition Facility at the Livermore National Laboratory, that scientific result demonstrated that you could take about 2 megajoules of laser energy focused onto a deuterium-tritium tiny capsule and produce 3.5 megajoules of fusion energy. So a net energy gain of 1.5 megajoules. So the number of megajoules sounds like a very large amount of energy, but to put things in perspective, that is 1.5 megajoules is just a little bit more than the energy needed to boil a gallon of water. So that was nonetheless a very important scientific result. Also, people don't generally know that it took 400 megajoules of electrical power to charge up the lasers. So the amount of energy, net energy from those experiments is actually negative. Quite a bit more energy was required to produce the laser light that was focused on the capsule. And that particular technique of inertial fusion is called indirect drive, where the lasers are focused onto a metal, very small metal can around the outside of the fuel pellet. And the laser hitting the inside of the can produces X-rays, which are then focused onto this spherical deuterium-tritium fuel pellet and cause it to implode to become a very dense, hot matter that produces the fusion reactions that resulted in the 3.5 megajoules of energy. This is not really practical for making electrical power. Another technique known as direct drive, where the laser light is focused directly on the pellets themselves, that is being looked at as a potential energy source. This would have to be done on the order of 10 times a second. This small capsules of fuel would have to be moving in a chamber, and so the lasers would have to focus on this, a moving target. And there's quite a few engineering challenges to make this into a viable energy source. Nonetheless, it's a very important scientific result, and many scientists thought that it would never be possible to demonstrate net fusion energy from such a system. The other fusion system that people are looking at is magnetic confinement fusion. In this scheme, the plasma is generated using energetic microwaves or other forms of electrical power. And that plasma is confined in a magnetic bottle, which means a geometry, usually a torus like a donut, is surrounded by magnets, coils, electrical coils that produce a magnetic field in the shape of the donut. And that confines the plasma to the donut. This type of confinement is possible to generate plasmas that are over 100 million degrees for finite periods of time. And so that is actually the system that we work on at Oak Ridge National Lab. And we have been working on this for, like I said, over 60 years, trying to come up with confinement systems that geometries that can confine the plasma at a reasonable level to produce enough reactions to produce net energy.
Some of our listeners might have heard the word tokamak, which sounds, I don't know, like an Indian word or something. But I think that's a type of reactor, and I think that it's the one that's associated with magnetic confinement. Is that right?
Yes, the tokamak is it's a Russian word, and it means essentially means magnetic bottle, and it was originally developed in Russia in the 70s, and it is a donut-shaped device. Electrical current flows in the plasma, so there's electrical current in a donut that produces part of the magnetic field that confines the plasma to keep it in the donut. There's another magnetic geometry similar. It's also donut-shaped, but there is no electrical current flowing in the plasma. And this is known as a stellarator, which was invented here in the U.S. back in the 1950s. The tokamak, when it first was developed, produced much better confinement and much higher temperature plasmas. And so the research scientists around the world primarily gave up on the stellarator and concentrated on the tokamak ever since. The stellarator has come back into vogue in the last couple decades, and there's now been some very important results there. And there are some advantages of that technique over the tokamak. Nonetheless, the tokamak remains the primary scheme for demonstrating magnetic confinement fusion energy, and there's a very large tokamak being built right now in the south of France, known as ITER. And the U.S. is a 10% partner in this project that's made up of not only the U.S., but Europe, Russia, China, Korea, India, and Japan. So it's very much a world effort to try and demonstrate that you can confine a plasma in this tokamak geometry, the donut, for a long enough time to demonstrate net fusion energy output. Again, it's not counting, however, all of the energy that goes into the facility to make the hot plasma.
Yeah, as you said before. Yeah, I was reading about ITER, which I guess stands for the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. And I guess in December 2023, just a little while back, Japan inaugurated a facility that's the world's largest operational superconducting tokamak. And I think you said earlier that kind of demonstration efforts have been pursued with that kind of reactor. And I guess this is an example of that. And so the goal of that Japanese tokamak is to show that these designs can produce fusion energy on a commercial scale. So I guess it's a model for scaling up fusion reactors. But you mentioned all the countries that are participating in the European version of that, which is kind of scaling it up. And 35 countries, I think. I mean, who coordinates 35 countries? It's like the UN. It's kind of hard to manage. Just briefly, how is that done?
Well, it is quite a challenge to keep such a project in line when you have people working on it all over the world. Fortunately, English is the language used in the project. And yeah. Everybody can read the same engineering drawings, which is also very important that everybody can understand the design aspect. But it is a difficult challenge to make such a project work.
Is that something that ORNL is participating in as one of those, you know, participants of that wide-ranging global effort?
Yes, Oak Ridge has a number of researchers like myself that work on the design aspects of various parts of ITER. Also, the U.S. domestic agency, the Project Office for all of the U.S. contributions to ITER, is at Oak Ridge as a separate division within the laboratory where engineers are busy and involved working with industry in the U.S. to produce components that will be put onto the ITER tokamak.
So is there one overall kind of czar or guru who's in charge of this whole umbrella operation? Is it, for example, in the European Union, or who would that be, or what organization would that be if there is such a thing?
There is a director general, and he is a European gentleman who has been in this role for a relatively short time, a couple of years. There's been, I believe, three other director generals during the ITER project. The ITER started in 1988 as the concept came about during a meeting between President Reagan and President Gorbachev. And then other countries joined in. Construction was started in 2007, so it's been under construction now for 15 years. But the concept has been developing for over 35 years. The unique feature of ITER is that it will actually use deuterium and tritium as the fuel in the plasma. This has been done at an experimental level on the TFTR tokamak here in the U.S. and the JET tokamak in England, which just finished operating after 40 years of research. But those experiments were very short-lived, where the deuterium and tritium reacted for only a few seconds. ITER is designed to operate for 5 minutes at very energetic plasma conditions that will produce more fusion energy out than is put in to heat the plasma. You mentioned the JT60 device. That's JT60SA. It's the third generation JT60 device in Japan. This one just came online. It's a superconducting device, which means the coils that surround the plasma to produce the magnetic field are superconductors. They have no resistance, and they're very efficient at producing the magnetic field. ITER will also use superconducting magnets. In fact, all of the reactor concepts in the world utilize superconducting magnets in order for the fusion reactor to be economically viable.
So how heavily is the U.S. government involved in fusion energy development now? I mean, is it backing one approach more than the other? And has it gotten a lot of eggs in that basket? Or, you know, overall, from a 30,000-foot level, I mean, how heavily are we into this as a country?
The U.S. is now spending about $700 million per year on fusion research. Of that, a third of that is geared toward the ITER project. And so this is all for magnetic confinement fusion. The laser fusion, inertial fusion that I mentioned earlier, is being it's being developed at a lower level financially by the government. And it's also used as part of the weapons program to investigate the viability of our weapons stockpile, because the same reactions occur in a nuclear weapon, the implosion of the nuclear material.
Is this really a race where one of the two approaches will win? And, you know, maybe there'll be a surprise in the magnetic, in the inertial confinement fusion part of it. I mean, you know, is it like one will win and that'll be the one that's used for commercial reactors? Or is it likely that both will be used? I think you alluded to a partial use of the other one somehow.
I think that it's more likely that magnetic fusion would be used for electricity production. However, there could be some developments in the inertial fusion that make it more economically viable. So it's worth pursuing both. It's not really a race. Clearly, if one does produce useful energy, then that will be the dominant one going forward.
So, you know, just briefly, and we're getting toward the end of the show here, but what are the main technical hurdles before fusion becomes commercialized? I mean, is the current electrical power generation grid adapted to fusion, or would it need major expensive changes? And just kind of briefly.
So the electrical grid we have now is quite well suited to a fusion reactor environment, where fission reactors that we have now could be supplemented with more fusion reactors. They would typically be large facilities producing at least 500 megawatts of electricity in order for it to be economically viable. And our grid is already set up for that size of power producing device. A lot of fossil fuel plants are on that order from 500 to a couple of 500 megawatts to 2000 megawatts of electricity. And so fusion would fit very nicely into our existing grid. So that is not a challenge. There are, however, a number of scientific and technical challenges that remain. One is producing a plasma that has high enough steady state performance where it's self-heating. In other words, the energy from the fusion reactions is enough to keep the plasma at a hot level to produce more fusion reactions.
Self-sustaining. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, that's, what's your personal guess as to the timetable for commercial availability of large-scale fusion generators? I mean, we talking years, decades, or what do you think? What's your guess?
Well, fusion has always been talked about as 20 years away. Ever since I've been working in the field, it's always been talked like that. And I think realistically, that is where we're at now. What has changed in the last few years and maybe in the last decade is that the scientific viability of fusion has been nearly demonstrated. And so that's made a lot of people more excited about the possibilities, and private industry has gotten involved. And there's been now over $6 billion of capital raised around the world by private companies to try and develop fusion systems. And so I think that with the innovation that private companies bring to the table, that coupled with the publicly supported program at national laboratories and universities, I think we have a good chance of making good progress in the next couple decades to get very close to demonstrating electrical production. It's not guaranteed that it will be achievable, but because of the advantages to both our environment and the endless supply of fuel, it's definitely worth pursuing.
Well, we just have, 30 seconds left here or so, so it may be an unfair question to ask you, but do you think, Dr. Baylor, that it will actually turn out to be the ultimate solution to global energy needs that it's predicted to be? I'm kind of harking back to my anecdote about fission energy being too cheap to meter.
Well, I'm sure it will never be too cheap to meter if fusion power is produced.
It won't be worth making, right?
That's right. So that's an important aspect, is it has to be economical. And sure. I think there's a good chance that it can be made that way. It will require a lot of effort by some really, really smart people, innovative people. And I hope for my grandchildren's sake that it can be made to happen in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it could save the world in the end or come closer to it than we're coming now, right? So, well, we're out of time. So, everybody, if you want to learn a little bit more about this technically, and if you're intrigued by all of this and want to know more about it, you can go to ornl.gov. That's Oak Ridge National Laboratory, ornl.gov, and just search nuclear fusion energy or fusion energy, and you'll find it. I want to thank you, Dr. Larry Baylor, for being on with us here on American Variety. It's been very interesting.
Thank you, Cort. It's been great talking with you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.